I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next. A dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
This is What's Next. I'm host Thomas O'Neill White, and it is my pleasure to bring back to the program Shayna Broughton. Shayna is a doula and creator and CEO of Our Mommy Village. Shayna, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have a passion for birth. Ever since you were a child, this is true?
Yes, yes. So I was 3 years old. I remember them asking me, what do you want to be? Oh, mom. So I was very little. I do remember that. And from there, I actually just adored babies, like loved them so much, and was always fascinated with pregnancy. So I'm mm-hmm. like, oh my gosh, there's a baby in there. So from there, it just grew more and more, just loving people.
And what led you to be more active in the fight for birth equity?
Well, after having my first child, things were not so great. I was not treated well in the hospital. And to be honest, I didn't know that there was a whole issue with how Black and brown moms were being treated in the hospitals, but I felt it firsthand. So birth equity came after I had my first baby. It'll be 19 years next week.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
And you are a doula. Mm-hmm. For our audience who may not know, what is a doula and what does a doula do?
A doula is a birth partner, kind of like a birth sister that basically helps you to transition through your pregnancy. So first, second, third trimester, and even into postpartum. We are basically just accountability buddies, I suppose, if you want to look at it like that. And as they're going through the process, the things that are good to know and the things that they might want to look out for.
What are some of those things?
For me, I always like for moms to check in with themselves to make sure that they are being treated well when they go into the doctor's offices, if they're being treated with respect when they ask questions. I always encourage them not to go by themselves because a lot of things are said when they are alone that they can't back up. So they don't always know that it is really a moment to keep yourself safe too, because you don't know who's in the room with you.
And how long have doulas been around? I mean, I think, is doula a new term?
I think there's always been a birth sisterhood, always. I think that it's a newer term, I suppose, that people are recognizing a little more, like it's an official term.
Yes.
But sisters have always been helping their fellow sisters who have having babies. And to be honest, I couldn't tell you when it wasn't prevalent, uh-huh. you know, like to yeah. be honest, like my own sister got pregnant and I immediately knew that I was preparing her to have her first baby. So whatever that meant was me learning with her.
Yeah. Tell us about that story, because mm-hmm. you found out that, yes, the doula life is for
that
me.
That was it. Well, my sister was 17 and she had chose to preserve the life of her baby against what many thought she should have done, which was not to have the baby. And because I stood so firmly on making sure that she did not need for anything, and I was still, I'm only 3 years older than her, but I was determined to make sure that she was safe and that my nephew was safe. So from that point, I made sure that she had food and that she basically had as much support around her as possible. She couldn't sign for herself. We lived together to make sure that I was close by while she was going through her whole process. It was her first baby. So I was learning things and she was learning things, but I knew that I was not going to allow anything to happen.
It's becoming more known, the stark differences with Black and brown mothers and their babies. They are more likely to face life-threatening conditions while going through pregnancy than their white counterparts. What are the maternal mortality rates for Black women and white women in the United States?
Well, I know for sure that it is over 80% for Black women. As a whole, I could not tell you as much because my focal point is like, because it's over 80%, it can't possibly be that much better for any woman, really. You know, but Black women, it's pretty bad.
So, you know, we look at someone like Serena Williams, the tennis star, who is, you know, one of the most recognizable athletes in the entire world, who's, you know, money's not an issue for her. And she's talked a lot about her difficulties with her pregnancies. So with the advances in medicine and healthcare over the decades, why does this remain a problem? It's not, obviously not money.
It's not a money issue.
Is it an access issue?
It is still the systemic racism that has created the system in the first place. It is deeply rooted biases that we basically don't consider. Like, the country was built on nonsense. So we have to think about these practices are still deeply embedded in everything that we do. I can still go to a hospital right now and be treated differently because I'm Black in 2024. So I think if we started to create safer spaces, like, and saw more, you know, doctors and nurses that look like us, it's starting to, you know, become a little bit better. But how many Black folk are dying still because they have not seen anyone to look like them and they don't trust the system to even go? You know what I mean? Like, it starts so small, like when they're really little, and we don't address it. They grow up and then they have this fear.
Right.
You don't even know where it comes from sometimes. And we, you know, like, if we start to think about it, it starts with a jab of the arm and you're holding somebody down and the baby is crying, screaming. We're supposed to trust these people with our bodies. And then we don't know what's best for us because we're trusting a system to tell us instead.
Mm-hmm. And that system, trying to trust that system, you mentioned, yes, it's getting better with more
people of color,
more people of color in these spaces. But at the end of the day, the system is still a racist system.
It really is.
So how do we further break down that system and build it back up?
Well, for me, I believe that we should take a lot of the, like, even the hospitals, because not all hospitals are bad either, but even how they serve Black folk, you know, like, for me, how you serve a Black person is different because you know that these are the numbers that are looming over them. You know, like, I think that we can break it down by having these conversations. I know that there are moms right now that did not have these conversations with their care providers, but they have babies.
Mm-hmm.
You go the whole 9 months not having these conversations, even if you trust your doctor, you know what I mean?
Yes.
Like, the numbers are still terrible. You know, like, you're still finding yourself in situations where the numbers are over 80% and they're preventable. A lot of that has to do with the mistrust of the professionals and the patient. You know, I feel like if we're intentional about having the conversation in the first place, then we'll start to see some things break down. And not demonizing the hospital, but educating and giving resources.
Is that why a doula is so important, just to have someone almost like an attorney present with you when you go get checked out, when you're going to a hospital or just seeing a primary care physician, to have someone in your corner as a, not like a barrier, but as someone to filter information both ways?
I feel like I am a walking resource when I'm in there with the mom, because there are a lot of things that I understand and there are a lot of things that they understand, but there's a lot of stuff that she doesn't know. So trying to get, you know, the middle ground, like, you know, so that we are navigating the same thing. And we all want one band, one sound for this young lady. We want her to come out with a new beautiful baby and we want her to be well. I like to stand in the gap for that. You know what I mean? Like, I'm pretty much making sure that nobody is saying something on this side that I can't back up, and nothing is being said by her that she's not being heard. You know, like, I'm kind of a liaison, but I won't speak for her. She will speak for herself. You know, I'm just there as an extra set of ears. She learns how to advocate for herself because
That's
the information is, yes, it's her information. So yes, her blood pressure, she should know about. She should know, like, if she's having issues with blood pressure or if she's having heart palpitations or if there's underlying issues, she should be able to navigate those things herself and have these conversations because it affects her ultimately. You know what I mean? Like, so we kind of blindly go into these places and just let people tell you.
Yes.
Instead of you understanding for yourself. So these mothers that have babies that have not had these conversations, it's important that we have these conversations. Doulas can help.
Yeah.
Doulas help have the conversation.
You mentioned to me off air that postpartum recovery is a very big issue with you. Actually, you start at the end and
yes,
work backwards.
I do. So postpartum recovery is important because there are a lot of factors that we don't consider when a mom gets pregnant. What is her home life like? You know, like her mental state. Not everybody is prepared. Not everybody comes from a different background. And I mean, we all have different walks of life. So I do consider a lot of the postpartum recovery to be like us preparing while we are also in birth, while we are also talking about breastfeeding. We're talking about who's going to be there for you afterwards? Who's going to provide space for you to cry or space for you to take a shower, or who's going to be here to help you with the housework? Those are the things that are really important. But we get so involved with ourselves that we forget that there's somebody next door probably handling business by themselves. You know what I mean? Like, we really should start to have an approach of making sure that we're accountable for the moms before they have these babies. Not saying that there isn't, you know, a village for them, but giving people assignments so that we're not guessing. You know what I mean?
Right, like, and not
scrambling. You are going to get food.
Yes.
You are going to make sure she showers.
Uh-huh.
You are going to make sure that she is resting. You know what I mean? Like, we have people that if we direct the energy a certain way, we can get everything accomplished. And if she doesn't have a strong network, that's why I'm around. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like I'm a doula, but I'm like a doula, auntie, mama, sister. You know what I mean?
Right,
like, so I'm going to love her like a mom or a sister. And I'm also going to collectively get everybody to come together so that we all rally around her, which is something that we do intentionally.
And that's, you know, creating that village.
Yes.
And on the local level, let's talk about your business or your organization, Our Mommy Village, filling in those gaps that are necessary for a healthy pregnancy and beyond. You take a holistic approach.
Yes, I do. I start with the stress level. What's going on at home? How do you handle things mentally when you're stressed out? You know, like, we have hard conversations right away just because then it helps me to care for her better. And for me, there are 8 ways to be well, and that is in every person. So I address it based on those things, not necessarily like the medical stuff, like medicines and things like that, but more holistic. You could actually take an herb for that. You could actually have a tea for that. You could get outside and get some sunshine. You could put your feet in the grass. You could really hug a tree. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm more like, nature teaches us things too, and we kind of negate some of those things, or the 8 different ways to be well. Your environment is important, you know, like allowing her to have these thoughts in her brain before the baby comes so that we can have these conversations about all the different ways to be well. She's not just thinking it's about the baby now. It's not about the baby now. It is about how you handle yourself while taking care of your baby.
Mm-hmm. You said birth heals the modern village. And obviously, you know, we always talk about it takes a village to raise the child. Well, what is the modern village? What does that encompass?
The modern village for me, because we don't all have the same background, we don't all have the same upbringing. You got some moms that are coming without mothers. You got some moms that are coming without fathers, no male background. They don't actually understand what it means to make healthy decisions. They're doing things differently than maybe their family. We come together based on, you know, like what we all want, which is to be better, you know, better at being a mother, better at being, you know, a woman, better at, you know, being responsible for our families, you know, making decisions that are good for us. So we're basically sticking together, all of us that want to do better. We're building each other up. We're creating a sustainable village around each other so that we are making decisions that collectively will heal not just us as a village, but a community. We're sending these babies out into the world with different upbringing and experiences. You know, like they are not in, you know, traumatic experiences anymore. They are coming out of it and they are learning how to enjoy life and be more present. So I think it's just something completely different.
So the large village?
Right now we have 70 plus.
Wow. Is it mothers and babies?
Over 70 babies, because we have four sets of twins.
Wow.
Yes, and bless her heart, we had one pass, and I love her dearly, but I believe that year we ended up with all girls, and on her birthday, three baby girls were born.
Wow.
Including myself. I had a baby on that same day, a little earlier. But yeah, it's been a blessing, and all of our little babies, they all play together. So I mean, like, it's really sweet because even if we're not meeting together in person, they are doing other things together.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you've got babies around the same age and you've got tummy babies all going to roly-polies or something together, or they're taking walks together. So you'll see a lot of the moms just kind of linking up and doing stuff together.
What kind of like prenatal care? You obviously talked about postpartum recovery, prenatal care, education. Mm-hmm. What does our Mommy Village offer in that regard?
Well, we actually probably meet a little bit more than the allotment, which is, I think, I mean, meet four visits.
Mm-hmm.
But twice a month, we have a social gathering where we're together. But the education portion is kind of ongoing. Right now, we're switching things over to be more digital. But they have access to me. They have access to tools and information and even each other. But we basically have individual visits and social gatherings together that cover prenatal, postpartum, breastfeeding, comfort measures, things that you can use to de-stress, certain scents that might trigger you to relax a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
So all of that information is given to the mother from either me or another source in the village.
You've done hospital births, mm-hmm. and you've done home births. What's the difference? Is one more preferable than the other? Obviously, there's a lot of variables that go into mm-hmm. that. But just from your experience, you know, what are the differences? What's the same mm-hmm. between the two?
Well, for me, I've done both, and I'm not. I don't say anything against hospitals. However, the autonomy is different when you have a home birth.
Mm-hmm.
I had a home birth and I've also had a hospital birth. And to be honest, I was able to literally just have my baby with a home birth. My midwife was present. Her apprentice was present. My family was still able to come. There was no restriction on what I ate, what I drank. I could dance around. I could play music. I did not have to feel like I was being told what to do. I had no monitors on me. You know what I mean? Like, it was really just the lowest, you know, like just no invasion whatsoever.
Yes.
Even when I was laboring, she was perfectly okay with me just being alone when I did not want to be bothered. And it was just no issues at all. Like, I was just able to have my baby. Now, the hospital birth is a little bit different because I've been in there in the hospital myself and my experience was different, but there are some hospitals that really do still give you the autonomy
mm-hmm.
To do what you would like with your mamas. And for me, I say the difference is autonomy. You can't eat after a certain point. They will still give you the option for pain management. That's not, you know, an option at home. I think it's for low risk, you know, low risk is for home birth. If you have any risk at all, a hospital birth, but you can still find someone that can keep, you know, the autonomy. It's just there are more restrictions in the hospital
mm-hmm.
because you have more people. So you want to make sure that you're safe overall.
Right. And you mentioned the midwife.
Mm-hmm.
Is that someone who like assists in the birth?
She is the catcher.
She's the catcher.
So she's going to be the one to catch the baby. And it's still low invasion. It's not necessarily like as she's going to allow you to kind of get there on your own. You're not mm-hmm. going to necessarily be pushed as much, you know, to hurry it along. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, I hate to say it like that. But I mean, like, if you are in a hospital and it's been 12 hours, you know, they have things that they have to move along. The midwife is there. She catches the baby and she's a little more holistic too. So, you know, a doula and a midwife, pretty much they have a lot of the same principles, just not the same responsibilities.
Okay. All right. And you've got some speaking engagements this summer along Jefferson Avenue. Tell us a little bit about that.
So at the Meriwether Library, we will be doing our village interest meetings or village talks, where we basically are going to be speaking about a lot of the different ways of being well, what the village really is, and how we are healing the modern village. So that'll be once a month at Meriwether Library starting in July. And Friday Night Live starts on the 28th. We will also have a table set up and you can come and meet the doulas. You can do a line dance or two with me and you can get some information about birth work and how we are doing things just slightly differently. But birth work is very important.
So your conversations at the Meriwether Library, you are talking more broadly about healthcare?
I am speaking more about the wellness of the mother as she is going through her process, but also how this affects all of us pretty much. If she's not well, then she's producing babies that are not well. You know what I mean? Like, so we're having a deep conversation about why the village is so important still and why she needs people to rally around her so that she is well to take care of this baby.
Where do you see our mommy village in the next 3 to 5 years?
Oh, boy. I think about this every day. So I do foresee it growing, obviously, bigger than it is. I would love to see us in a bigger space. Right now, we are kind of traveling here and there and setting up wherever we can. But I would like a space to call our own and hopefully a big old farm one day.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah. So, I mean, honestly, like the holistic part of it is when we talk about grounding, when we talk about trees, when we talk about all of those things, like our food sources and being out and clean air, all of that goes hand in hand with our mommy village and how we heal as a community. We're like, we're bombarded by nonsense all day, every day in the city.
Yeah, right.
Let's take a travel out and maybe, you know, start to see things a little bit differently. So, clarity of, you know, like being well known for building a village that is literally going to end the Black maternal health systemic healthcare crisis, honestly.
Is that how you see your role moving forward?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I see that if we have one baby and one mom, that's already a ripple effect. It's already one baby and one mom that's doing things differently. And they're healthcare will be different and their trust factor will be different and the way that they operate will be completely different because healing and wellness is on the base.
How would one find a doula?
Well, I'm online. You can catch me online. I think that there is also a directory. You can Google it, but I am online. You can find me. My website is ourmommyvillage.org and I feel like there are so many different doulas that you do the research to find the one that best suits you. I'm more holistic, more like a sister. Not everybody needs that. But if you do, I'm most certainly that person.
All right. You're listening to What's Next. I want to thank my guest, Shayna Broughton, who is a doula and the creator and CEO of Our Mommy Village. Thank you for being with us. We'll be back with more What's Next after this.
Public Media is more than Morning Edition and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Buffalo Toronto Public Media creates digital series to ignite curiosity in young learners, free lesson plans, videos and training for teachers and parents, and events to empower the minds of our community's next generation. This is Public Media.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
This is What's Next. I'm host Thomas O'Neill White, and today we're talking Juneteenth, Black history, because it never stops, and racial literacy with returning guest LeGarrette King, who is the director of the Center for K through 12 Black History and Racial Literacy. LeGarrette, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
It's June. We talk about Juneteenth. The celebrations continue to grow. What is the historical significance of this day?
So the popular story with Juneteenth is the concept of, you know, after the Civil War, June 19th, 1864, one of the Union generals, Granger, you know, mm-hmm. came, and I believe some dockers out in Galveston, Texas, you know, were the first people to hear the concepts that, you know, Black people were now free
right.
in the United States, right? And this was, you know, a few years after the Emancipation Proclamation mm-hmm. and a few months after, like, the total surrender, right, you know, of the South, right, to the Union, mm-hmm. right, Union Army, right? So that's the popular story, you know, to that. But there's several different kind of misconceptions, you know, around the concept of Juneteenth.
Uh-huh. What are those misconceptions?
Well, the way in which we kind of understand Juneteenth is that Juneteenth was Black Independence Day, right?
Uh-huh.
But throughout history, there was never a singular Black Emancipation Day, right? Or Black Freedom Day,
right? Right.
In the United States alone, from 1780 to 1865, we've had 20 Emancipation Days throughout the country, right? That different communities celebrate throughout the year, right? So certain places, you know, don't celebrate Juneteenth, right? Mm-hmm. But they celebrate some form of emancipation.
Right.
Right. Like in Washington, D.C., in April, they celebrate their Emancipation Day because that's when, you know, enslaved people in Washington, D.C. were free, per se, from slavery. Right.
Right.
Some people celebrate the Emancipation Proclamation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So some people may be real familiar with going to church on New Year's Eve, right? And then they get out at New Year's, right? That was a celebration that was connected to the Emancipation Proclamation because of January 1st, 1863, mm-hmm. when the Emancipation Proclamation was there, right?
Yeah.
I read somewhere else that Florida celebrates May 20th as their Emancipation Day because that's when the state freed their slaves, right? So mm-hmm. so there's several different freedom days
yes.
Throughout the country, but Juneteenth has been kind of allocated as the Black Independence Day, which sometimes we have to be careful with.
Yeah, and it's interesting that something that was celebrated originally in Galveston, Texas, mm-hmm. has made its way all the way to Buffalo, New York, and
yes.
is celebrated.
Well, you know, Buffalo, of course, is part of the Great Migration.
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of people come from Mississippi and Alabama and Georgia and all those particular places, and they come and they bring their celebrations to, you know, the city, right? But also, I think we need to kind of rethink how we think about Juneteenth, right? Not only were there multiple Emancipation Days, we also have to be very careful of kind of that white savior narrative, right? You know, like,
yes.
oh, the Union, you know,
right.
came and saved Black people, because that just erases a lot of our history, particularly our history around agency, right?
Mm-hmm.
Black folk, of course, freed themselves all the time, you know, by running away from different plantation sites. You had these independent maroon colonies that sprung up, particularly within,
yes.
you know, the water areas.
Yeah, Virginia.
Yeah.
Southern
yeah.
Virginia.
Yeah, maroon colonies.
That's where my dad is from.
Yeah, so. Yeah, yeah. So you've had these enslaved, escaped the slave folk, right? Plus indigenous folks, sometimes coming together and creating their own communities and, you know, going and saving different people from different plantations, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, Black Independence Day is great. It's something that, you know, we will celebrate. But just historically, we have to understand that there has never been a time where there's only one Black Independence Day for Black folk. There's several.
So how do those Emancipation Days, along with Juneteenth, you know, how do they relate to other significant moments in African American history, like, as you brought up, the Emancipation Proclamation, like the Civil Rights Movement?
Mm-hmm. So when we learn about these different histories of Black history, the main kind of caveat I think people need to really understand, because sometimes, you hear young people say certain things, you know, I don't know, on social media or, you know, in their classrooms that is just ahistorical, right?
Like, right.
So there's this popular phrase, particularly like used during the Black Lives Matter movement. Hey, this is not your mama's and daddy's civil rights movement and all this stuff. And because we're more this and we're more that, you know, we want to. So this assumption is that despite the fact that Black people have historically been oppressed, you know, throughout history, there has always been strategies to make us free, right? To push against that oppression, right? So these particular independent days just show us, right, throughout history, that Black people have always fought for their freedom.
Right.
Right. And sometimes they didn't fight, you know, sometimes through nonviolence and being meek and being passive, right?
That's always the prevailing story. Mm-hmm. And to me, there's something nefarious behind that, no, you have to do it this way.
Yeah.
Not this other way that we're not going to talk about.
Well, why do we kind of approach, you know, kind of civil rights in that manner, right? So, you know, I've been in several different classrooms before, and I've listened to teachers teach about civil rights and civil rights movement. And there's a certain push for, hey, the best way to achieve freedom is through kind of quote unquote nonviolence,
right,
while we're learning about the violence that is happening towards the people who were nonviolent.
Exactly.
Right. And, you know, then you get to, oh, Malcolm X and the Panthers and all this. But even way before that, right, Kelly Carter Jackson has a new book out called We Resist. And she channels the history of Black people resisting through various different means, both violence and nonviolence. But the violence aspect is very interesting, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, hey, people didn't just sit around, right? There were slave revolts. There were black people owned guns. There were shootouts. There were this and that, all for, you know, the credence of freedom, right? So a lot of these young people, right, you know, particularly those that say those phrases, trust me, your grandmother was a beast probably.
Granny knew what was up. You mentioned the different emancipation celebrations, but specifically speaking of Juneteenth, because yes, there's a celebration here, there are celebrations down south. Do they vary from region to region, from state to state, for the states that do celebrate Juneteenth?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of similarities and differences, right? You, of course, within really Black cities, Texas, like Houston, Dallas, Austin to a certain extent, San Antonio to a certain extent, you'll have more elaborate Juneteenth celebrations, mainly because they've done it a lot, right?
Yes.
You know, but there's some similarities, right? So these Juneteenth celebrations, of course, you know, you have the cookouts, right, that people may have, which may be something more intimate, like a family reunion, or it could be something more citywide, you know, that's combined with like a festival type of, you know, setting. So it's a celebration. You have musical artists, you have dancing, you have education, you have vendors, et cetera, et cetera. So you have those particular spaces. You also have places that have Juneteenth pageants, right? Places that may have educational aspects at libraries, right? So, but most places kind of take that approach, you know, to celebrate. So it's a main like celebration of just life and Black culture and Black people.
As an aside, I kind of compare it to Southern hip hop.
Okay.
If you're not familiar with each city's style, you kind of think it's all the same.
Yeah.
But like Atlanta rappers, not really the same as Miami rappers, who are not exactly the same as Memphis or New Orleans or Houston. Talk about the same stuff, but maybe the slang's a little different.
Yeah.
Their cadence is different. You know, their accents are different, but it's all variations of Black hip hop culture. That's what I've always equated it to.
Yeah. And for the places that really celebrated and have been celebrating real good, I do understand Buffalo has a rich history for their Juneteenth. And I think UB has a group of people that will march, you know, during the parade. And so I know people are very excited about that.
You've taught in the South, Georgia and Texas specifically. You mentioned off air, you didn't teach about Juneteenth just because it was, you know, the school session was out, but there's definitely community events surrounding Juneteenth.
Yeah, we would definitely mention it if you're teaching like U.S. history survey course and
okay.
you're talking about the end of the war. You know, you'll bring up, hey, this is what began Juneteenth. And this was way before Juneteenth became a federal holiday for me.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned, obviously, Juneteenth is a federal holiday. What about other Emancipation Days, you know, being more widely recognized as a holiday? Does that seem like an uphill battle for you, given, especially given our current social and political climate?
Well, I've been noticing online and in various different things that I read that there is kind of a conservative pushback on, you know, Juneteenth, right? Calling it made up, which reality check, all holidays are made up, right? Like, there's no, like someone said, hey, I want to celebrate this, and then they create whatever.
Yes.
And so all holidays are made up. So I've seen that, right? And going back to this concept of being nefarious, it's like, dang, black folk can have anything. But to be fair, I don't think any black person really was calling for Juneteenth to be a federal holiday, really.
Mm-hmm.
But we got it, right?
Yes.
So now let's celebrate it, right? because this goes back to how certain people have this arrogance about history,
mm-hmm.
right? July 4th should only be our only Independence Day. And that's impossible with all the different groups of people that we have that have lived in this country who have been oppressed by those people that believed in independence, right?
Right.
So that's a very arrogant statement to say, hey, Juneteenth is made up when July 4th is made up as well. But when I think about why we celebrate it, right, we really celebrate as a big party, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, the saying goes, I think, like after the black dock workers heard General Granger, they celebrated for 7 days straight, right? Using the black church because that was the safest place, you know, to do those things. But there's something about certain groups of people not wanting black people to be joyful.
Right.
Right. And while we can...
Policing
the joy. And it's weird, right? It's like, because beforehand, I've known communities that have celebrated Juneteenth or at least understood what Juneteenth was, and white people knew nothing about it,
mm-hmm.
right? And didn't even really care to know, right? And then all of a sudden, there's this, like, hey, we care about it, right?
Yeah.
So it's weird, but yeah, the celebration should be pushed everywhere. Everyone should, you know, join and learn a lot, you know, about the different aspects, because while Juneteenth is a joyous celebration, we also have to understand that the history behind these Emancipation Days haven't always been joyful, right?
Mm-hmm.
So what's interesting is there's kind of three characteristics around these Emancipation Days that happened to black people. Number one, there was always this gradual emancipation.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That, you know, black folks just couldn't be free right then and there.
Right.
There's always this gradual, even the Emancipation Proclamation. It was just like those states that were covered by the North and not the states that were still slave states. You know, those people were, you know, slaves. But there's always a gradual aspect. Also, while you may have a law, right, whether it's federal or local or whatever the case may be, you still have the same Congress people that didn't believe that black people should be free.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So a law is only good if it's enforced.
Exactly.
Right. You know, and then last and probably the most interesting aspect about these Emancipation Days is that essentially black people had to pay to be free or be indebted to be free, while slave owners benefited
mm-hmm.
and got reparations, you know,
right.
You know, for losing their quote unquote property, right? So you see this all the time, you know, throughout history. So those types of things need to be learned, right? So as we move forward with various different aspects, particularly the reparations debate, right? And studying reparations and studying who needs to have reparations, those aspects, even when black people are free, there's suffering that comes along with that freedom.
As an educator and talking about the need for people to be educated on these topics, it must be discouraging to see parts of the country and the school boards outright banning books.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of those from you know, African-American authors, African-American perspectives.
Yeah. And it's also very frustrating since we're only 4 years removed from the quote unquote racial reckoning. Right.
Right.
Everyone was down for, you know, diversity education. Everyone was down for trying to understand the history of our country. And then all of a sudden, in the snap of a finger, everybody kind of.
It's like the Thanos snap.
It's like, yeah. All the pearls were gone. It was just like, wow, you know, it's crazy. And I guess what's more heartening is that people who kind of understand history knew that there was going to be a backlash somewhere.
Right.
Right.
There always is.
Right. We knew that there was going to be a backlash for Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, because I mean, I remember thinking, I hope this brother make it his first 4 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I was surprised he got a second 4 years, right?
Right.
So I was just kind of waiting on, well, where's the backlash? And you saw it boiling over these 8 years and all these narratives and discourses about all this stuff. And then it, you know, kind of proceeded with the election of a certain person and the ideology and what that person kind of stood for, right? Mm-hmm. Or that person represented what these people stood for, right?
Exactly.
Type of aspects, yeah. Right? So go back to the question.
Oh, just being discouraged in seeing these book bannings.
I guess I'm more kind of discouraged because we had all these people who said, we believe this and we want to learn more. We want to do this. You know, we want to push for equity. We want to push. And then all of a sudden, it seems like there's been a very weak pushback against these racist policies and anti-black policies that are going on in certain school boards and school systems, right? So, yeah, it's very discouraging when there's so much that we need to learn about our country so we do not repeat those same things that we've been repeating for 400 years.
Mm-hmm. So what's the solution to this problem?
Man, the solution will be a hard one because, of course, if we had a solution, we wouldn't be doing this, right?
Yeah.
Over and over and over and over and over again, right? I don't know what's going on in the political sphere where there seems to be some type of helpless, you know, since we are in a majority two-party system, that one party doesn't seem like another party who is supposed to be against those things are pushing hard enough, you know, to stop those things from happening. It seems like something is helpless, or they're helpless in doing these things. I think community members need to be a little bit more advocate for those things, run for school boards. School boards are a very interesting political entity, right? Because a lot of
it's not supposed to be political, right?
Yeah. and you'll notice that school boards, particularly for those who want to be politicians, are typically kind of that first in way to, you know, political aspects.
Right.
Yeah, school boards are not supposed to be political in that nature, but they are very much so. But yeah, people, I would encourage people to, you know, run for the school boards and other local elections, particularly if they care about those particular issues. Education is extremely important in this, right? I still do believe if people know more, they do better.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because, you know, we keep on falling for the same discourses each generation, mainly because we're not educated. Right.
Right.
So, yeah, more activism within the communities and within places where people have some type of influence.
And how can people on an individual level best honor the legacy of Juneteenth and these other emancipation holidays and its importance to American history?
I think for individuals, we need to begin to start sharing educational books and articles about Juneteenth. I know there's a lot of people on social media that do, you know, small reels on it because that's kind of the popular way that people like to learn now, I think. And just spread the word and maybe even have more neighborhood focus aspects for Juneteenth, because I know Buffalo has a large one for the city, but it would be amazing to see particularly mixed neighborhoods have different celebrations with speakers and other celebrations.
That would be nice.
Within those particular spaces, right?
This is What's Next, and we're talking with LeGarrett King from the University of Buffalo. LeGarrett, I wanted to get your opinion on a news story that has come up recently. Mm-hmm. The Oklahoma Supreme Court dismissed the lawsuit by the survivors of the racist massacre in Tulsa in 1921. The plaintiffs had been seeking reparations for over 100 years, and they're all, you know, 102, 103 years old. What does that decision by the Oklahoma Supreme Court say to you?
that Black lives do not matter. When we look at the history of the United States, there has been several groups that have received reparations for things that were done to them by the U.S. government, different communities. And this is a different approach than a national call for reparations, right? Because now you have a small group of people within a local city that we have the pull yourselves up from the bootstraps mentality here. And we had a group that pulled themselves up from the bootstraps,
exactly.
Right? What, one generation, and they built, you know, this part of town, like in other parts of the United States where Black communities created their Black Wall Streets, right?
Right.
Throughout the country. And it was destroyed in a matter of hours and days, right? So their properties was lost. And I thought the United States was very prominent in this notion of property. Your property matters. And these people's properties and their way of life were turned upside down. Some people had to move and all these particular things. And for those people not to receive reparations is disheartening. And it continues to prove that there's a layered system of justice that we have in the United States. And, you know, for the people who always come, who get the short end of the stick, is always Black folk. And this has been something that everyone knows now.
Right.
Right? You know, we know the history, and we've been knowing the history for years. Movies and documentaries, people have testified in front of Congress about these things. And for them not to receive reparations for Tulsa is anti-Black, racist, and disheartening.
And along those lines, we in Western New York recently recognized the second anniversary of the racist massacre here in the city of Buffalo. There's been differing opinions on how far we've progressed with regards to race relations in the region and addressing the socioeconomic issues plaguing parts of Buffalo's East Side. Does it seem like we still have a long way to go in those areas?
It does seem that way. I know there was major talk about socioeconomic improvements within the area. I'm not sure if those promises have been fulfilled. I'm not privy to meetings or, you know, strategies, but of course it doesn't really seem like business as usual, right? For the city of Buffalo and the way in which they treat their Black citizens. So in terms of race relations, I don't think we moved the needle that much. You know, the problem, I think a lot of times these conversations, because someone would, you know, kind of combat it and say, well, no, there's no discrimination. There's no this or no that. But we really don't look at kind of institutional policies that restrict various different aspects. We don't look at kind of the capitalism that occurs that have been created to create certain people out of certain.
Right. Perpetuating these systemic racist policies.
Yeah. Yeah. And until we get governments that understand the systematic and institutional ways that we restrict people, particularly people of color and Black folk, then, you know, we're always going to see this concept of discrimination as something that's individual. And that's not the way to kind of approach, you know, aspects, particularly when we're supposed to be in a place that lost themselves as a city of good neighbors, and who lost themselves as equitable people.
So what role does education play in creating a more equitable society and challenging the status quo?
Yeah, education is probably top three, right? For you to have a healthy democracy, you have to have a healthy educational system. And when we look at a topic of history that I teach, you know, you cannot have a strong democracy if your history education is poor, right? Because history kind of sets the foundation for everything. And I don't think people really realize that, right? It's like, what's one of the first things that the doctor asks you when you go to the doctor? He asks about your medical history, right? Because he can predict what's going to happen if you continue to do different things based on your medical and family history, right? Your credit score is based on your history because people are trying to predict whether or not you're going to pay your bills, right? You know, so I don't understand why we don't think about our history. If we know our history, we can predict what will happen if we continue on this way, right? You know what I'm saying? And for us, so now we're going to be a little bit more knowledgeable about these policies that we're in, right? And more knowledgeable about, you know, doing various different things, you know, that, you know, people can kind of identify and hopefully push forward with something different.
Talk to me about resiliency. Because we've run down three instances, Juneteenth, Tulsa, Buffalo, where Black resiliency is shown through. How do we do it? How do we keep doing it? How do we keep persevering?
You know what is sad, right? It's sad what I'm going to say. Because it just seems like we expect it. We expect oppression. We understand it's there, so we're just waiting for it to happen, right?
Yes.
While we're living our life, right?
The other shoe is always going to drop.
Yeah. So I think that's why we get so upset with folk, particularly Black folk, that may say, oh, no, this is not, no, this is not, oh, yeah, we're progressing. And we're just like, okay, all right, well, we'll see, right?
Yeah,
we're just
right,
kinda,
right.
We're just kind of waiting and just living our lives. And because of that, sometimes our home lives as we grow up are not as healthy as they should be, right? Because we have parents and other caregivers that push us.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes a little bit too hard, because we understand that for us to survive in this system, for us to be resilient, we have to do things a little bit better. We can't mess up, right? We have to be in the straight and narrow. We can't be doing this. We can't be doing that. And,
right.
You know,
we got to look a certain way. We got to talk a certain way.
We have to look a certain way, talk a certain way. And, you know, for us to think that we're quote unquote successful. So we're resilient in that particular aspect. We have this grit, but like sometimes is that good for our mental health?
No.
Right?
Or our physical health.
Yeah. I mean, as a kid, like, we're telling kids, don't you act up in the store.
Yeah, right.
don't you do it. You know, you're not getting that. You know, and you know, at dinner, you have to do it. And then the other kids are looking at other kids, and they're playing, and they're running around, and they're free. And you know what I'm saying? You're looking at your mother, and your mother looking at you like, you better not, right? Type of accident, uh-huh. Right? So this pursuit of perfectionist is really tough. So while we laud that as something that, hey, you know, we need to be excellent, right? Sometimes that excellence can be damaging.
Yeah.
You know,
detrimental in a lot of
ways. Right. To our emotional aspects. But after that, I was talking to a friend of mine the other day, and we were watching something and something happened. I forget. And we just said, man, Black folk don't take nothing serious. Like, you know, because we joke about everything.
Everything.
No matter how bad it is or whatever, we just joke about it. So there's the uniqueness to us. Right.
Right.
Where we understand that stuff could happen and most likely will happen. And we're surprised if it doesn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
Right. To us just enjoying ourselves and being who we are.
We are very good at dulling the pain in a humorous way.
Yeah.
It's like I don't know anyone else who can do that.
Yeah, I mean, and that's the healthy side, I think, that kind of balances out the pressures of, you know, being a Black person who's trying to, you know, do major things in our society, right? It's that, man, I have to do this, and, you know, and it's tough. It's mm-hmm. tough, but we are resilient. But then we also have to question, are we being too resilient, you know, when we don't have to even live like that sometimes?
Right, and when it's too much and we show emotion,
mm-hmm.
we get criticized for it.
Oh man, yeah. And that's so poorly. You know, I have a wonderful colleague, Brittany Jones, who just joined us at the University of Buffalo, and her research is focused on the concepts of emotionality,
mm-hmm.
right? You know, in Blackness and in history. And what she found was, and the reason why I'm saying this is because history kind of mirrors the way that we treat people in the present, right? So what we learn, typically we learn how to treat people through what we know of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what her dissertation study kind of focused on, you know, Virginia and the emotions of Black people in the curriculum. And what she found was that within the curriculum, there was always these instances of white people's and their emotions. White people were fearful that Black people would attack them. White people were fearful of this, so they did that. They were scared. And mm-hmm. while there were instances of oppression on Black people in that curriculum, they never mentioned their emotions. They never mentioned whether they were scared. They never mentioned whether they had these rageful or whatever. And it goes back to our previous conversation about this concept of nonviolence. And like, we just have to sit there and just take it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And if we show any type of emotions that rage, then all of a sudden we're demonized.
And then that violence becomes twofold against us.
Exactly. And And what's interesting about the whole thing, this country was created based on violence.
Mm-hmm.
Violence is in our natural fabric. You know,
it's as American as apple pie.
It is, right? So, I mean, no one said, hey, you know, the colonists should have marched on, you know, for King George, right? No, they threw some tea overboard. Mm-hmm. No, they had a war, right? They had all this stuff for their freedom, and we celebrate that. But if black folk have a little, you know, social unrest because of police brutality or because of anything, then it's like, oh, look at them. They can't control their emotions. Why are they tearing up their own communities, et cetera, et cetera, right? And the way in which we understand blackness, you know, through our understanding of black people is really detrimental, what you said.
I want to pivot to your Black Nerds group.
Mm-hmm.
Can you refresh our audience about what this group is about?
Oh, Black History Nerds, we're just a bunch of nerds that wake up on Saturday mornings to learn about Black history, right? I am the HNIC, the head nerd in charge. And for our younger listeners, you need to watch Lean On Me if you haven't watched one of the best teacher movies out there.
Mm-hmm.
But Black History Nerds happens every second Saturday of the month, starting in September and again May. We have a Black History Nerds every weekend or every Saturday in February. But this is just a place where for an hour where people can come and just learn about Black history topics, Black life and culture. One of our highlights people loved this past year is that we had a presentation, and everyone can go to the website and watch the archives of the shows, but our first Black History Nerds session dealt with gentlemen who were on what the scholar would say life row, which most people would know death row, right?
Right.
And, you know, we talked about the prison, you know, system and what goes on in the prison system. And those gentlemen actually wrote a curriculum, a social studies curriculum that, you know, the researcher Rachel will have out very soon that we'll have on our website soon as well. And then our second to last one, we had a professor from Georgetown talk about black elephants in the room. So we talked about the concepts of black conservatives, right?
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah. And I really wanted this session because I always tell people, I said, you know what? Black people are more conservative than people think.
Right.
You know.
Especially when we talk about the churches.
Yeah. Yeah. The churches and just all these particular things. The problem is there's a difference between black conservatives and black Republicans. Right. You know, are those who vote Republican who consider themselves conservative. Right. So, you know, we had a lovely session on that. A little fiery. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Session or whatever the case may be. More fiery than other sessions. But I think it was very educative.
And then you've got something coming up, micro-credential.
Yes. So starting in the fall of 2024, we're starting a new teaching Black history micro-credential for educators and other people who are proponents of Black history education. And what this does is this micro-credential will help those who are going into the classroom, those who want to do community work around Black history, become better Black history and more effective Black history teachers. One of the problems we have historically, there hasn't been major problems in creating Black history courses in our schools.
Mm-hmm.
The problem has always been who will teach those classes.
Right.
Because those teachers are kind of the promotion for the class. So if you have a poor teacher of Black history, then those classes are not going to be successful. If you have a great teacher of Black history, those classes and those programs will become successful. So the micro-credential kind of acts as that educative process for people who are already teachers, those who are training to be teachers, those who want to do community education, you know, to teach more effectively. So we're starting that fall of 24. We actually have a virtual informational on June 20th from 7 to 8 p.m. that people can join and learn more about it. And the micro-credential will last about a year, you know, from September to July, concluding with the Teaching Black History Conference. Mm-hmm.
Now, would someone need to, like, re-up on the micro-credential moving forward? How would that work?
Yeah, so the micro-credential website should be on the website, the Center for K-12 Black History and Racial Literacy Education website. And you could just click on and learn about the different courses that we'll have, the instructors we will have, and the benefits that it will have for both teachers, administrators, community members, et cetera.
And what are some of the courses that are on?
So we have two major courses, which would be Teaching Black History 1 and Teaching Black History 2. 2. Now, those courses would be foundational to kind of understanding my Black History framework, which is Black Historical Consciousness. And that framework has been adopted at many school districts around the country and in Canada, right? So you'll learn as you're building curriculum, you're building, creating your lesson plans, you're building programs around Black history, what are the principles that you need to really focus on to actually teach a humanistic and more holistic Black history program.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. You're listening to What's Next, and I want to thank my guest, LeGarrett King, for being on with us again. Always a pleasure, sir.
This is WBFO and WBFO HD1 Buffalo, WOLN Olean, and WUBJ Jamestown, your NPR station.